Merkle Media.
Flashback Fridays here in Macroaggressions, taking you back to May 6th, 2020, episode number 19, Project for a New American Century. If you're interested in converting some of your soon-to-be hyperinflated away and worthless fiat currencies, or maybe even your retirement accounts, into tangible precious metals like gold and silver, go to our website, www.macroaggressions.gold. Tony Arterburn over at Wise Wolf, he'll hook you up. Now, please enjoy the show.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Marius, Tack Theratrix.
I am Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
Swangled in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Hey everybody, welcome to Macroaggressions. My name is Charlie Robinson. I am your host. I know you got a lot of choices out there when it comes to listening to podcasts. I certainly do appreciate you checking me out. If you want information on the show, you can go to the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Check it out there. Twitter, you can follow me at Moefus, M-O-W-E-F-U-S. I mean, maybe you can follow me there, maybe not. I'm currently suspended from Twitter on an indefinite suspension. I suggested in a comment on somebody's post about Bill Gates that I said, when are we going to throw this guy into a volcano? And that got me suspended indefinitely for inciting violence. I mean, give me a break. Let's be honest. This is nonsense. But anyway, you can follow me there or not. I don't know. Facebook. /theoctopusofglobalcontrol. I do a lot there. I'm starting to get into Twitter, but they're making it kind of hard for me to love it. So Facebook has some information as well. I try to post in both places. So this episode is about 9/11. And it is, it's an event that, you know, I think for a lot of people, it was the event that woke us up to the nonsense that we are sold on a nightly basis by our mainstream news. And it's not to say that I had it all figured out on 9/11. It took me a couple of years. But when I look back on the trigger event, it was 9/11 in a general sense, but Building 7 in a more specific sense. And so that's what we're going to cover in this episode. And it's not to say that this will be the only episode on 9/11, because over the last couple of months, I've become close with Richard Gage, who is the head of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. He's going to come on the show. We'll obviously get into the components, the scientific factors with regard to building collapses, and we'll go into more detail with him on that. But But there's we could do an entire series on 9/11, and probably will, to be honest with you. So there's a lot to unpack. This will be the first episode where we get into it, but it certainly will not be the last. But I think if you're going to understand 9/11, what you need to do is kind of give yourself a little lesson in history and back up a little bit to understand how false flag operations work. Well, first of all, you have to understand what they are. And we did that a little bit on the last episode. We talked about false flags, but there's more than just, there's more than just recent school shootings and things like that. You go back in time, and what you notice is that, I think just about every war has been kicked off with a false flag. You talk about the sinking of the Lusitania. There's the Reichstag fire that kicked off World War II. In Europe, at least, there's Pearl Harbor, which wasn't necessarily a false flag, but it was an event where there was foreknowledge of an impending crisis. We have potential false flags in Operation Northwoods. You have actual false flags in the Gulf of Tonkin and the original World Trade Center bombing in 1993. The Oklahoma City bombing was a false flag attack conducted by the FBI, which when you just drop that out on somebody without any context, you're like, what are you? No, don't say that. That was horrible. All those kids died. Well, yes, it was horrible. And the FBI's fingerprints were all over it, figuratively and literally with regard to the bomb. So to back up to kind of semi-recent history here, World War II, which of course was 70 years ago or so, but it's to understand 9/11, you have to understand Nazi Germany. You have to understand the way they thought about things. And what happened was that in 1933, there was a fire at the Reichstag building in Berlin. And this was really seen, this event was seen as pivotal in the establishment of Nazi Germany. Adolf Hitler was sworn into power as Chancellor of Germany a month earlier. He urged President von Hindenburg to quickly push through emergency decree to suspend civil liberties. Where do we see that? So that they could round up the Communist Party of Germany. You know, at what constitutes being a communist, of course, is unclear. But what you'll see is that there is a pattern that formed. And 9/11 was not as original of a concept as you might be led to believe. This had been going on for years and years. So 9/11 was following a blueprint that was laid out by other psychopathic regimes that had come before them, of course, the Nazis in Germany. So, you know, Hitler wound up accomplishing his mission of creating an enemy that the people of Germany could focus their anger on, while at the same time portraying himself as a strong leader that was looking out for his people, you know, like the type of guy that really gets stuff done. And if you think back on 9/11, we saw the same thing with George W. Bush, you know, grabbing the bullhorn, standing up on the big rubble pile and talking about how the people that knocked these buildings down will hear from us soon enough, and you know, demonizing Muslims, and he's going to lead us. And he was calling it a crusade, which is fucking insane to say that when you realize what the crusades actually were. But that's George W. Bush phrase. But, you know, even back during World War II, it was fairly, you know, I wouldn't say it was known, but it was suspected that the fire in the Reichstag was actually set by the German soldiers posing as communists to frame them. And of course, that's exactly what it was. And since communists don't really wear uniforms or cut their hair in a particular way, it pretty much anyone had the potential to be labeled as one and consequentially tossed into a prison or shot. And there was a lot of that going on. So one could really identify the guy who like owns the your competing business. Let's say you ran a business in Germany. You could just out your competitor and say that I think that guy's a communist and watch that guy get dragged away and shot, you know, eliminating the competition problem. So everybody was a communist, you know, everybody that they didn't like, they just pointed fingers to and said, they're a communist. Kind of like we do now with every, hey, you're a terrorist, you're a domestic terrorist. Ooh, you know, you don't have to be a, you don't have to be a Muslim anymore. Although God forbid if you are a Muslim living in the United States and somebody has a problem with you, I mean, they can just slap that label on you and watch as your life is destroyed. It happens all the time. You know, that's sort of what happens when you rile up a bunch of small-minded bigots. You can get them thinking that there's communists around every corner, or that the Muslims are coming to get them, or they're gonna, you know, force them for, you know, they're gonna come get us here and force us into Sharia law, and we got to go get them before they come here and get us. Which of course is utter nonsense, but it doesn't matter because the facts are irrelevant in a time of war and things like that. So you have the Reichstag fire, which is basically a real event pulled off by a faction of German soldiers, made to look like that it was from the communists, and that was the pretext to sort of ramp up the paranoia, hysteria, and to really get the Germans into a position where they started to say, well, you know, we have to build up our armaments because the communists are coming to get us. And it really works effectively for scaring the population, for closing ranks and becoming unified and behind a common leader. In this case, it was Adolf Hitler. Von Hindenburg was, you know, tossed aside pretty quickly after that. It's a way to consolidate political parties into one unit. When you say, well, listen, we can't have these petty squabbles between Democrats and Republicans. Our real enemies are the terrorists. We have to come together and pass the Patriot Act, and we have to grant extraordinary powers of, you know, rendition, which is of course kidnapping and torture, or enhanced interrogation. Sorry, I almost forgot the Orwellian term, enhanced interrogation, which is beating the shit out of somebody until they give you information, regardless of whether the information is good or bad. That's enhanced interrogation. So all of these things that seem unthinkable, you know, pre the event, suddenly become not only an option, not only a reasonable option, but the people demand it. And what's interesting about that, the psychology behind it, is that it's very easy to convince everybody else to get on board, because what you do is you just denounce the people that aren't pushing for war as being pacifists, or, you know, a danger to the country, that they're putting the rest of us in harm's way by not being pro-war. And then you just let peer pressure, society, mob rule, and of course, authoritarian dictators take care of those people. And pretty soon there is no argument about it. Everyone is in agreement that this is what we have to do, and it starts the chain reaction. And so that's why false flags have been around for so long. They work very well. And so you move past World War II, past Pearl Harbor, which was, like I said, it wasn't a false flag necessarily. The Japanese did attack the United States, but there were high-ranking people in the American military that had advanced knowledge of the plan, which is why the aircraft carriers were moved to the backside of the island, which is why the older ships were the ones left in Pearl Harbor. And they allowed that attack to happen as the pretense to join the war. And immediately after that attack, war was declared on Japan. And then Germany, by default, declared war against the United States because of their pact that they had with Japan. So that's sort of how it starts. But then you get into the 60s with Kennedy, and you have Operation Northwoods. And the plan, so American military leaders drafted a plan to create public support for a war against Cuba. in order to oust Fidel Castro from power. So the plan included committing acts of terrorism in U.S. cities, killing innocent people and, of course, U.S. soldiers, blowing up U.S. Ships, sinking boats of Cuban refugees, and even hijacking airplanes. Interesting. Of course, so the plans were literally approved by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but Kennedy flat out rejected them. He just said, we're not doing that. But in these plans, one of them included hijacking airliners, switching them out for remote controlled drone airplanes that were meant to look the same, then blowing these planes up and blaming it on Cuba. Now that is almost identical to the plan for 9/11. And what we've sort of talked about, or we've come to realize, is that for all of the effort and all of the energy that these globalist scumbags put into their plans, they typically don't get very creative. It's kind of the same plan over and over again. They lack a sense of originality. They just kind of use the same plans over and over again. And, you know, maybe that's because they work. In this particular case with Operation Northwoods, they didn't work. But they hijacked, well, maybe that's the wrong word. They stole the idea for Operation Northwoods and used a chunk of that for 9/11. And so then you move a little bit past that. Just a couple years later, 1967, you have what is called the attack on the USS Liberty. And this is an attack that doesn't get a whole lot of play. It was a Navy intelligence ship that was attacked by Israeli fighter jets while in international waters, about 12 miles offshore of Egypt. It wound up killing 34 people. It injured 170 other. And Israel claimed that they had made a mistake with identifying the ship, but information gathered years later disproved their claims that it was a mistake. It was intentional. So why would Israel intentionally attack the American ship, especially when one considers the close relationship between the two countries? Well, the reason for doing so was to pin the attack on Egypt, and as a way to draw the United States into a conflict between Israel and Egypt. So Israel planned for the USS Liberty to be sunk, but the ship managed to stay afloat even after being shot up for more than 2 hours. So Israel had to scrap their plan because there were just too many witnesses on the ship that survived that could identify the attackers. Instead, Israel decided to claim that there was confusion on their part and that the attack was some sort of misunderstanding or accident, which it was not. It absolutely was not. So here's some here's a quote from the book. Here's some transmissions back and forth. This is Israeli pilot to ground control. This is an American ship. Do you still want us to attack? Ground control says, yes, follow orders. Israeli pilot, but sir, it's an American ship. I can see the flag. Ground control, never mind. Hit it. So you also have Lyndon Johnson, who says, quote, I don't care if the ship goes down. I'm not going to war with an ally over a couple of sailors. So he wasn't concerned that Israel shot down the ship. He certainly wasn't going to, you know, once it came out that they had shot up the ship, he wasn't going to kick off a war with that. Well, Lyndon Johnson was a closeted homosexual who was being blackmailed by the Israelis. So, I mean, that guy would say or do whatever they wanted him to say or do. In fact, he was fully aware and briefed and on board with the sinking of the USS Liberty. In fact, he's quoted as saying, I want that goddamn ship on the bottom of the ocean. Okay, so you want to talk about one of the most reprehensible people in United States history. You talk about Lyndon Johnson. There are crazy stories about that guy. He was a sociopath of the highest order. And when you I think everybody understands that he had a role in the Kennedy assassination, if not, at the very minimum foreknowledge of it, because guess who became president? He did. Guess who didn't run for re-election? He didn't. He was a really disgusting human being. So you go from the USS Liberty and then you get into the Gulf of Tonkin event in Vietnam. And what that was there was a US ship that was, this happened actually, it happened on two different occasions, August 2nd and August 4th in 1964. And it involved an alleged attack by a couple of North Vietnamese boats against a few United States ships in the Gulf of Tonkin. This was the single biggest, most important reason for the escalation of the Vietnam War. What happened was that the North Vietnamese boats attacked the American ships, and therefore it created this pretense to go into the pretext, I should say, to go into Vietnam to kick off that war. Only there's one problem. The attack never happened. So this is a false flag without an attack, which is a really weird one. They just said they got hit. they didn't, but they said so. In a 2005 declassified document, it concluded that the USS Maddox had engaged the North Vietnamese on August 2nd, but that there may have not been any North Vietnamese vessels present during the engagement on August 4th. In fact, the quote is, "It is not simply that there is a different story as to what happened. It is that no attack happened that night." So they faked it. They faked that they had been attacked, and that was used as a pretext. So then that, of course, gets you into 9/11. And I was not in Manhattan on the morning of September 11th, 2001. I was in Manhattan Beach, California, on the other side of the country, as far away as you can, as far away as you can be. And I remember waking up, I had friends staying over because they were supposed to be going to the airport the next morning. And I get woken up at like 6:15 or 6:30 or whatever. And my friend says, "You need to come out and see this TV. And of course, we started to watch and were glued to the television like many people were. And it was all very confusing. And the information was, it was chaos. And of course, you don't expect there to be any sort of understanding of what is actually happening because it's fresh, you know, and there's a lot going on and it's hard to know what the facts were. But one thing that was pretty consistent was that it was Osama bin Laden. And that started being pushed by Paul Bremer. And Paul Bremer was a high-ranking guy at Marsh & McLennan. He was a terrorism expert, or maybe technically a counterterrorism expert. I don't know. He wound up getting the job to run the Iraq reconstitution program, even though he was totally unqualified and had no business being there for that. He's a neocon. He was one of those Bushy guys, you know, one of those scumbags that once wore a neocon, what they would call, you know, one of the Project for a New American Century dudes. I don't think he had anything to do with the writing of it, but he was involved with that group. And so you don't hear about PNAC. You don't hear about that, the document that they wrote, until years later. And once you hear about it, it makes you think, well, that's an interesting thing to write. It was written in September of 2000. So 12 months before the attack. And one of the lines from it is haunting and insightful and coincidental all at once. And most people have heard it, but I'll read it again. "Further, the process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor." And wouldn't you know it, they got their catalyzing, catastrophic event that George W. Bush described as the new Pearl Harbor. That's awfully coincidental. And so what you notice is that after 9/11, there were plans drawn up for us to invade Afghanistan, you know, because all those Afghanis were on on the plane. Oh, wait. No, there weren't any Afghanis. They were Saudis, right? So why don't we attack Saudi Arabia? Oh, yeah, because they're on our side. Yeah, I forgot. So the plan to invade Afghanistan came together relatively quick, wouldn't you say? Seemed like it was only a matter of weeks before that was pushed out to the American public and through the use of the media. Let's take a quick break so that we can hear from the sponsors that make this show possible, like Delete Me. The tech giants make a fortune selling your personal information to all kinds of outlets for them to use as they please. Delete Me removes your personal information like name, address, age, phone number, email address, and photos of your home from leading data broker sites. Removing personal information from data broker websites reduces your online footprint and removes Google search results. These guys really understand opt-out and privacy policies, so you don't have to spend your time focusing on things like legal jargon. Delete Me has been featured in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, NPR, and CNET. With over 20 million personal listings removed, Delete Me is the most trusted and proven privacy solution available, so check them out by using the link in the description to see just how they can take back your personal information. And Fiverr is an outstanding resource. If you need somebody to outsource some of your work to, or you just need specialized help with a project that you're working on, you need to check out Fiverr. They have a network of thousands of freelance experts in business, design, programming and tech, digital marketing, music and audio, video and animation, writing and translation, and so much more. Need someone to build out a website or help you grow your current business with a digital marketing campaign? You can find thousands of people ready to get to work on your project at a fixed price that you set at Fiverr. Your payments only released to the freelancer once you're pleased and approve the work you've received. If you have questions, you can call Fiverr 24/7. Just click the link in the box in the description. Start putting this army of freelancers to work for you. And Cash Advance. We are living through a very strange time filled with an unbelievable amount of uncertainty. We don't know what the world's going to look like weeks from now, let alone months from now. If you find yourself in a financial emergency and in need of money right away, you at least have an option with Cash Advance. You can submit your request online and receive an answer in minutes so that you will know where you stand and what programs they have available for you. Their online service is entirely free and works to find potential lenders in their network. So just fill out the secure online form and see which option works best for you. Look, I hope you don't need this service, but if you do during this crazy time in our lives, at least you know that you have another option with Cash Advance. Click the link in the description box to see what they have to offer. And with all of these sponsors, your support for them directly impacts and supports the show. We certainly do appreciate that. Now let's get back to the show. So who was Project for a New American Century? What are they all about? So I'll read the description. Project for a New American Century was a neoconservative think tank based in Washington, D.C. that focused on United States foreign policy. It was established as a nonprofit educational organization in 1997 and founded by William Crystal and Robert Kagan. The PNAC's stated goal was, quote, to promote American global leadership. The organization stated that American leadership is good both for America and for the world, and sought to build support for a Reaganite policy of military strength and moral clarity. The Project for a New American Century ceased to function in 2006. It was replaced by New Think Tank Foreign Policy Initiative, co-founded by Crystal and Kagan in 2009. PNAC's first public act was to release a statement of principles on June 3rd, 1997. The statement had 25 signers, including project members and outside supporters. 10 went on to serve in the administration of President George W. Bush, including Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and Paul Wolfowitz. The statement of principles described the United States as the world's preeminent power and said that the nation faced a challenge to shape a new century favorable to American principles and interests. And in order to achieve this goal, the statement signers called for significant increases in defense spending and for the promotion of political and economic freedoms abroad. So it said that the United States should strengthen ties with its democratic allies, challenge regimes hostile to our interests and values, and preserve and extend an international order friendly to our security, our prosperity, and our principles. It concluded that PNAC's principles were necessary if the United States is to build on the success of the past century and to ensure our security and our greatness in the next. One of PNAC's most influential publications was a 90-page report titled Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategies, Forces, and Resources for a New Century. That's where the catastrophic and catalyzing event came from that 90-page report called Rebuilding America's Defenses. Citing PNAC's 1997 Statement of Principles, Rebuilding America's Defenses asserted that the United States should seek to preserve and extend its position of global leadership by maintaining a preeminence of U.S. military forces. So what it did was it recommended four core missions for U.S. military forces: the defense of the American homeland, the fighting and winning of multiple simultaneous major theater wars, the performance of constabulary duties associated with shaping the security environment in key regions, and the transformation of U.S. forces to exploit the revolution in military affairs. So these guys were pushing for war. That's their plan. That's what PNAC was all about. So you might ask, who's in PNAC? Well, I'm going to read through a list of people that you might recognize. There's more than just these people, but these will be the names that jump out to you. Elliot Abrams, Richard Armitage, John Bolton, Max Boot, William F. Buckley Jr., Jeb Bush, Frank Carlucci, Dick Cheney, Elliot Cohen, David Epstein, Steve Forbes, Donald Kagan, Robert Kagan, Zalmay Khalilzad. I think I butchered that guy's name, but I see it everywhere. Charles Krauthammer, William Crystal. Of course, William Crystal is one of the co-founders. Scooter Libby, Ed Meese, Richard Perl. Richard Perl, by the way, that guy is a straight-up psychopath of the highest order. Dan Quayle, Donald Rumsfeld. Donald Rumsfeld pushing for war? Yeah, don't say. I would have never guessed that. Dov Zakheim and Bob Zelick, among other, as well as Paul Wolfowitz and James Wolseley. So there's a lot of guys in there. But one of the things, if you wanted to draw some sort of parallels as to what do these guys all have in common, besides being reprehensible psychopaths of the highest order, which goes without saying. Well, a lot of them are dual U.S.-Israeli citizens, for one thing. And that is a problem, because that's not supposed to happen. You know, you're not supposed to have dual citizens in your running your political establishments. But when it comes to dual Israeli citizens, they're everywhere, right? Now, it's not to say that, you know, someone will say, oh, dual loyalty, that's an anti-Semitic trope. No, what it is stating an obvious fact. If you have dual citizenship, you have the potential for dual loyalty. Does it mean that you always do? No. Does it mean that you could? Absolutely. Frankly, you don't have to have dual citizenship to have the potential for dual loyalty. But if you have citizenship in two different countries and you are in American politics, it is a reasonable question to ask if there is a tendency to err on the side that benefits your other country as well. So I don't think that's unreasonable to ask that question. In fact, I think anyone telling you that it's unreasonable to ask that question should be questioned themselves, because it's an obvious question to ask. So these guys all have ties to they're obviously high ranking in government or big business, or they have either current or were formerly, you know, James Woolsey was in there, Frank Carlucci was in there. These guys were high ranking members in Reagan administration. You know, they were involved. They know how it works. They've left office to go on and do other things. Frank Carlucci started the Carlyle Group. George H.W. Bush was meeting with the Bin Ladens on the morning of 9/11 on behalf of the Carlyle Group. Frank Carlucci is involved in PNAC, which called for this catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. So there's overlap between all these people. Now, does it mean that the PNAC was the only ones involved in the push, you know, for 9/11? No, it doesn't mean that they're the only ones involved, but if you want to look at for a list of suspects who had motive and opportunity to pull off 9/11, let me just set your mind at ease. It's not 19 Arab hijackers with box cutters that didn't know how to fly planes, okay? Let's just settle that once and for all. That is what is known as bullshit. That is what the media pushes in conjunction with the military to create a narrative that we have to be careful because these Muslims, if we don't go get them, they'll come get us. This is a lie. This is what 9/11 was based off of. There were people that were warning about it before 9/11 happened. In fact, Bill Cooper said this. He said this on June 28th, 2001. 75 days before 9/11 happened, he said, "I'm telling you, be prepared for a major attack, but it won't be Osama bin Laden. It will be those behind the New World Order. Whatever is going to happen, they are going to blame on Osama bin Laden. Don't you even believe it." He said that 75 days before it happened. What, does he have a DeLorean? Is he going back and going to the future and figuring it out? Or does maybe Bill Cooper... did he have an understanding about the way things actually really work? Maybe he studied the writings of Zbigniew Brzezinski, because in his book, Global Chessboard, he said, "Moreover, as America becomes an increasingly multicultural society, it may find it more difficult to fashion a consensus on foreign policy issues, except in the circumstance of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat." Well, he's right. He knows. He knows how psychology works. He understands that. He was a mastermind of that. Zbigniew Brzezinski was a co-founder of the Trilateral Commission, and they were pushing for world government. If anyone would know how to shape public opinion, it would be Zbigniew Brzezinski, and he's talking about it quite openly here. And then you can just listen to Dr. Kevin Barrett. He is a PhD an Arabist Islamologist. I don't even know if that's a word, but that's what it says. He's the author of books. He's done a lot of work on the topic of 9/11 and the role of PNAC, and this is what he said. "A real investigation of 9/11 would destabilize the United States political system, and it could even lead to civil war. The truth about 9/11 is so horrific that if the American people actually were to learn that truth, they would completely lose confidence in their system, because the truth of the matter is that a faction of power here in the United States, the neoconservative faction, orchestrated the events of September 11th, 2001 as a new Pearl Harbor designed to launch their agenda of world domination and a rollback of freedom in the United States." Well, that's ding, 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 ding. Kevin Barrett's right. This is what happened. This is what happened when you've got guys like Norman Mineta, who was the Secretary of Transportation, saying this. He says, he's talking about the morning of 9/11, they were in the PIOC, which is the safe room for the president, that's like well underground, adjacent to the White House. He's down there with Cheney and a bunch of these guys. During the time, this is what he said, Norman Mineta. During the time that the airplane was coming into the Pentagon, there was a young man who would come in and say to the vice president, the plane is 50 miles out. The plane is 30 miles out. Then it got down to the plane is 10 miles out. The young man also said to the vice president, do the orders still stand? And the vice president turned and whipped his neck around and said, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary? So Norman Mineta is telling the story of Dick Cheney giving orders that still stand as a plane is inbound. What are those orders? Were the orders to shoot down the plane? No, because they didn't. The orders had to be to not shoot down the plane. So why would Dick Cheney be giving orders to not shoot down an inbound aircraft that was coming towards Washington, D.C.? Well, the answer is because he wanted it to come in and crash. It's part of the plan. Dick Cheney is one of the Project for New American Century guys. He knew what was going on. He reconfigured the war games. He ordered stand down, gave stand down authorization. He made sure that George W. Bush, that big dummy, was out reading kids' books in Florida that day. So he'd be out of the picture and he could be in charge. I mean, you know, people think of Dick Cheney as Darth Vader for a reason, you know? He's a criminal psychopathic mastermind, and he was knee deep in this stuff. So the document, Rebuilding America's Defenses, the PNAC document, is a business plan for empire building, war, and genocide. It was written by a group of psychopaths. Like I said, a large portion of them with dual citizenship that were looking to destabilize the Middle East through a fake war on terror. And they put the whole thing on America's corporate credit card. I think the estimates show not just Afghanistan, but Iraq combined, in conjunction with the future liabilities, are somewhere north of $6 trillion. That's $6,000 billion. Surely that money could have been spent on anything better than dropping bombs on the Middle East. But of course, that's not what we got, right? We got endless wars, a destruction of our reputation around the world, and all under the guise of trying to find this criminal terrorist mastermind, Osama bin Laden. We spent trillions of dollars turning the world upside down to find this guy. And it turns out all we really had to do to find the people that were behind the attack was walk down the hall in the Pentagon to the E-ring. And that's where they all were. The founder, the co-founder of PNAC, Bill Kristol, said, whenever I hear anything described as a heartless assault on our children, I tend to think it's a good idea. Well, of course you do, Bill. You know why? Because you're an asshole. But if you want to understand the octopus that I talk about in the book, you have to understand 9/11. It is fundamental to understanding that there is a much bigger plan. Without knowing the backstory, there's no point in even examining the other aspects of control. They won't make sense. And in fact, if you just go by the official story offered by the government and the media, it doesn't make much sense either, because it's just so full of holes. It lacks any connection to reality. The more you dig into it, the less likely it seems. But you know, it was a made-for-TV event. And they'll give you warnings when you watch your nightly news. You know, warning. This is going, you know, graphic content. You know, it might be a shooting, or it might be a story about a dog attack some kid or something, you know, something awful like that. They don't give you that warning when they show the buildings exploding, do they? No, they don't give you that warning before they show the buildings coming down. That was a snuff video. 9/11 was a snuff video featuring 3,000 dead people, or 3,000 people that were turned into sand in those, in the destruction of those buildings, the explosion of those buildings, the implosion of those buildings. You know, many people had a very difficult time, made a sneaking suspicion that there was something that wasn't quite adding up about how a bunch of Saudis that couldn't even fly Cessnas were able to outsmart the most elaborate intelligence system in the history of the planet while somehow knocking down three buildings with two planes in Manhattan. Plus they hit the Pentagon. Plus they hit a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania in their airplanes, but they didn't leave any airplane debris. That's an interesting aspect of this, don't you think? Nobody really seems to talk about Shanksville. There were coroners, there were FBI agents, there were all kinds of people, former, current and former police all on the scene. They all said the same thing. There were no bodies. There were no seats. There was no luggage. There was nothing. There was just a gigantic hole that was steaming and there was no airplane wreckage. Same thing with the Pentagon. We've got 200 cameras mounted on the most heavily defended building in the world, probably. And the only thing that we get is three still frames of what doesn't show an airplane and looks a hell of a lot like a missile slamming into the side of the Pentagon. That's all we got. I mean, look, if an airplane flew into the Pentagon, let's see the footage. Let's see it. Don't tell me you don't have it. You've got it. What, did all those cameras get switched off? Did Epstein's security guards at the prison switch off all the cameras at the Pentagon? It's a hell of a coincidence that we've got three frames of still footage of it that shows a gigantic fireball. And let's just not even get into the fact that in order to hit the Pentagon at that angle, you would have to be flying that thing practically parallel to the ground, which is impossible to do at that speed with an airplane. Like, the whole story doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's just... But one thing that most people don't know is that the invasion of Afghanistan was planned months before September 11th, 2001. And in fact, the National Security Directive to invade Afghanistan was sitting on President Bush's desk on September 4th, 2001, a week before 9/11. Who was drafting Bush's foreign policy? Karnak? The Magnificent? Was he holding envelopes up to his head and just thinking very hard, Afghanistan did it? I mean, the story, the official story of 9/11 is not true. I hope you realize that. If this is the first time you're hearing this information, I must sound like a deranged lunatic, but Jesus, I mean, you've had almost 20 years to figure it out. What's your excuse? I mean, I understand we all get busy at work, but like, if you still think 9/11 was conducted by 19 Arab hijackers with box cutters, I mean, you're out of your fucking mind. You honestly owe it to yourself and to the people around you to wake the hell up. And it just, they lied to us through the media. And it was an elaborate lie and it was well crafted and we bought it and I bought it. I mean, I bought it for years. But at some point, you have to take some responsibility for your own understanding of reality. And if you're not understanding that 9/11 couldn't have happened and didn't happen the way it was portrayed, then you're not doing yourself any favors. Now, we can debate whether it was suitcase nukes in the elevator shaft or thermite or thermate or nanothermite or directed energy. I've heard all kinds of fake planes, real planes, drone planes, invisible planes. You know, I've heard it all. And we can debate those topics. And it's worth debating those topics. In fact, when I have Richard Gage on, we'll talk about thermite and thermate. He did a great presentation at Anarchapulco a couple days ago that I just saw. I spent hours with him talking about all kinds of these of ideas and questions and all of these things. But what is not up for debate is that those buildings were brought down intentionally. A third building was hit on 9/11. That's Building 7, otherwise known as the Solomon Brothers building. It came down at 5:25 in the afternoon of September 11th. It was brought down by a controlled demolition. That is not my opinion. That is a fact. It was announced on the BBC 25 minutes before it actually happened. It was announced, there's videos of it being announced by security guards, construction type guys, announcing to the camera crews to move back because the building is coming down. And it came down in its own footprint at free fall speed. And Larry Silverstein, the owner of the complex, said that we'd had such terrible loss of life that we made the decision to pull it. And we watched as the building came down. Well, let me just tell you this. You cannot rig a 47-story steel frame building for implosion in 8 hours, even under the best of circumstances. Even if you had 1,000 guys working in concert, even if you were not in the middle of a war zone where buildings were exploding hundreds of, you know, a couple hundred yards away from you. It's an impossibility. What Larry Silverstein said should put him in prison. He is a co-conspirator. You can't do that. You can't rig a building in an afternoon. And you don't have to be an engineer to understand that. And you don't have to be an engineer to understand to just do this simple eyeball test when you watch that building. There is a very predominant kink at the top of the building, which is consistent with the way a building is destroyed. We've all seen the hotels in Las Vegas that have been imploded. They follow a very same pattern. You can see squibs exploding from the side, laterally ejecting material. And you can watch as the building is brought down symmetrically into its own footprint. That requires a lot of time and effort to rig that building. So for Larry Silverstein to come on and say that Building 7, they made the decision on that afternoon to rig it and take it down, is a lie. It's a lie by a guy who knows what really happened. It's a lie by a man that was involved in it, a co-conspirator. And let me remind you, Larry Silverstein has admitted that he has had, before 9/11 and many years afterwards, weekly Sunday conversations with his very good friend, Benjamin Netanyahu. There's always so many coincidences you can have before you start to sort of say, well, I'm starting to paint a picture here of advanced knowledge by some very influential people in the New York area and Washington, D.C. area. It seemed to know what was going on before it happened. And we also have to consider the dancing Israelis. If you're unfamiliar with dancing Israelis, look it up. Look it up online. This is a group of people that had their cameras on top of a van pointed in New Jersey, pointed at the Trade Center to capture it on film. And as the first plane hit, and as it hit, they were celebrating and dancing around. It was reported by one of the neighbors who saw them, called the police. The police were sent out, wound up arresting these guys in that van later as they were driving away. They were taken into custody. They were held for 60 days. They had explosives in the van. They were all Israelis. Okay. They had ties to the Mossad. And they were subsequently let out of jail after 60 days by Michael Chertoff, dual Israeli, U.S. citizen, first head of Department of Homeland, one of the first guys of the Department of Homeland Security, and the guy that made all the money on the body scanners at the airport. So, there's some questions. I got some questions, right? I got some questions about these people that were involved, such as, how did you know to set up the cameras in advance and aim it at that building? Why were you guys all celebrating? Why were, when you were pulled over, the police said, what are you doing? your response was, your problem's not with us. We're on your team. The problem that you have is with the Palestinians. What the fuck do the Palestinians have to do with it? Why are you filming an event that you couldn't have possibly known about in advance unless you had some involvement in it, unless you had foreknowledge? Is that an unreasonable question to ask? Of course not. Well, it is if you're a narrative manager and you don't want people talking about this sort of stuff. Richard Perle, who was one of the Project for a New American Century maniacs, said, "No stages. This is total war. We are fighting a variety of enemies. There are lots of them out there. All this talk about first we're going to do Afghanistan, then we will do Iraq, this is entirely the wrong way to go about it. If we just let our vision of the world go forth and we embrace it entirely and we don't try to piece together clever diplomacy but just wage a total war, our children will sing great songs about us years from now." You know, the term radicalized is a favorite of the U.S. media to slap on someone that has differing beliefs than, you know, those the media is trying to cram down our throats every night on the evening news. But Richard Perle is radicalized. There is zero doubt about this. This guy is a total maniac who wants nothing more than everybody to die and get out of his way so that he can rebuild the world in his image. They have, this is, these are psychopaths. And in fact, the whole crew of the PNAC are a bunch of white-collared maniacs. The group photo of these guys looks like the should be taken at the bar from Star Wars. I mean, it's just a bunch of... But I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to see Dick Cheney in the back corner blasting Greedo. You know what I mean? Like, this is who these people are. They're villains. You know, be careful in Mos Eisley spaceport, right? You know, I'll be careful. You'll be dead. You know, this is what these guys are. This is, but Richard Allen Miller, who's a good dude and he's a scientist. He said the 9/11 event was the need for a body count in order to get a terrorism bill through Congress. And that's the kind of government that we have here in America right now. And he's absolutely right. That's exactly what it was. You know, and you know, what part of that agenda for PNAC was increase an already enormous military budget at the expense of domestic and social programs, toppling of regimes resistant to our corporate interests, forcing democracy at the barrel of a gun in regions that have no history of the democratic process, and replacing the UN's role in preserving and extending international order. I mean, you ask, there's the question that you get into when you're dealing with a whodunit like this. Cui bono, right? That's the Latin term. Who benefits? So who has benefited from all this? You know, at the cost of thousands of 3,000 dead people on Americans are dead on 9/11, thousands of dead American soldiers, over a million dead Iraqis and Afghani civilians. Well, the very industries that funded PNAC benefit, of course, big energy, military industrial complex. I'm sure that comes as no surprise to anybody. Halliburton, once run by Vice President Dick Cheney, made billions of dollars from the reconstruction of Iraq and Afghanistan. Bechtel, once run by Donald Rumsfeld, made billions of dollars. You know, the company called Tirami, a defense company started by Richard Perle shortly before the invasion. Well, they made a bunch of money too. So it's one thing. I mean, it's bad enough to lie people into a war. It's bad enough to conduct false flag attacks. But these psychos are so greedy that they're trying to find ways to profit from it as well. I mean, if that doesn't qualify you as being a traitor, I don't know what does. And the fact that these guys gave no-bid contracts to their buddies, companies that they used to run, is... I don't understand why we are not marching on Washington with torches and pitchforks to get these guys out of office. I mean, the Yellow Vest movement in France has been going on for over a year. America is really great at a lot of things, but protesting and holding our government officials accountable is not one of them. We really suck at that. I mean, we are absolutely atrocious at it. And you know, it's a shame because we're being lied to constantly by our media and by our politicians. And we just sit back and do nothing about it. And this is not some sort of new concept that we're having to deal with. It's not like, oh, we have, you know, 21st century problems. Let me read you what Joseph Goebbels said. If you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it. The lie can be maintained only for such time as the state can shield the people from the political, economic, and or military consequences of the lie. It thus becomes vitally important for the state to use all of its powers to repress dissent, for the truth is the mortal enemy of the lie, and thus by extension, the truth is the greatest enemy of the state. Well, he would know. We're talking about Goebbels here. Nazi minister of propaganda, if you didn't recognize the name. You know, is this not what we're experiencing? 9/11 is the big lie. It's the biggest lie of our lifetime. You've got Kennedy and you've got 9/11. And people remember where they were when Kennedy died. Everyone except George H.W. Bush, of course, but everybody else that wasn't involved in it can remember where they were. People that were alive during 9/11, they can remember where they were. It's one of those things. You just kind of stopped and everybody felt really awful. And then everybody felt really connected, which was a weird thing. And then the United States had all of this sympathy around the world. For the first time, it was like, you remember when Mike Tyson got knocked out by Buster Douglas? Everyone went, oh my God, I never thought that guy could get knocked out. And people started to, not everybody, but some people kind of started to feel a little bit bad for Mike Tyson. Like, yeah, I know he's been out knocking guys out left and right for, you know, the last couple of years, and he's had this big rise. But then we saw him, you know, we saw a guy get knocked silly, put his mouthpiece in backwards and everything, and you kind of felt a little bit bad for him. And that's where the United States was after 9/11. The countries around the world that, you know, had been watching our aggression over the years and weren't fans of it, they took a step back and went, oh my God, that's really awful. What happened to them? I'm sure a lot of people said we had it coming to us, of course, but there were, you know, many countries that felt like, you know, we had sympathy and people felt like legitimately bad for us, for our people. And what did we do with that? We squandered it. We intentionally squandered it. We went out there and took that and used that as a pretext to go invade countries that had nothing to do with 9/11. Afghanistan. I'm sorry. I'm still waiting for somebody to explain to me what the fuck Afghanistan had to do with anything. Oh, Osama bin Laden was based there. Yeah, but he was a Saudi. he was, you know, we're going to go there and we're going to bomb them to the Stone Age. Well, what would that take? An afternoon? They're goat herders and rickshaw pullers and, you know, what are we doing? Those guys couldn't formulate a plan to, you know, fly airplanes into buildings and everything like that. The passports of the hijackers. When they weren't flying out of their pockets through burning airplanes across three city blocks and landing at the feet of FBI agents, what they were showing was that they were all a bunch of Saudis, or at least 15 of them were Saudis. So why didn't we go invade Saudi Arabia? Because they're our ally? Because it wasn't about that, of course. It was all designed to make it look like it was somebody else and give us the pretext for war. In fact, One of the things that George W. Bush said, one of the quotes was, one of the hardest parts of my job is to connect Iraq to the war on terror. Yeah, no shit, because they didn't have anything to do with it. That would be a difficult part of your job, is to make that connection, because it didn't exist. You had to have Colin Powell come out there with his vial, yellow kick uranium. They're using this, they're enriching it, and they got it from Niger, and they're going to be, all that stuff was bullshit, of course. It was a lie. The only question is, who knew it was a lie? How deep did you have to go into this sea of scumbags before you found somebody that wasn't in on the plan, didn't know what was happening? And you can't, you know, the logistics behind wars and things like that, there's a lot of planning that's involved. The fact that we were in Afghanistan almost immediately after that is a huge red flag. The fact that Shah Massoud was blown up the day before 9/11, and everyone that was in country there in Afghanistan, all the CIA assets that were already pre-positioned there, were thinking, uh-oh, this is not good. This is not good. They just blew up the freedom fighter, the one guy that would have been there to fight back against the United States, was suddenly blown to smithereens by a fake interview crew, right? So we've already got the plans to go into Afghanistan. We're there like 3 weeks later. Well, that's because they were, like I said, they were sitting on Bush's desk a week before the invasion. They'd been dreamed up years before that, just like the Patriot Act had been. All these things. So it is what the Nazis talked about with the Reichstag fire. This is how you get things done in a world that is resistant to arbitrarily starting bullshit wars across the world. You have to give them a reason to get behind it. And I will give them credit for 9/11, because what that did was, there were a bunch of people out there waving American flags, and we were ready to go get those bastards. We were ready to go get Osama bin Laden. Never mind the fact that Osama bin Laden's dad was meeting with George W. Bush's dad in Washington, D.C. on the morning of September 11th, 2001, on behalf of the Carlyle Group, and that one of the few airplanes that was allowed to leave after everything else was grounded was the plane carrying the bin Laden family. I'm sure that was all just a gigantic coincidence, though. 9/11 is a much bigger story than just this. It's bigger than PNAC. It's bigger than the dancing Israelis. It's bigger than Richard Pearl and all these guys. And we're going to get into it a little bit more. We're going to examine some of the backstory behind the buildings following, the mathematics and physics behind that, and what the ramifications were of three buildings being knocked down with two planes. Thanks for listening. Check out the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com, for anything show related.